Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, I'm Jackie Cation. You are about to listen to the Dork Forest. Let's give you the info about it. First of all, you know the websites. DorkForest.com, TheDorkForest.com, if you like a determiner, JackieCation.com has everything. All of my podcasts, including videos of my stand-up schedule, merchandise you can purchase if you would like, and a lot more info than you possibly even need. Let's do the credits. Mike Rickberg sang and produced and composed that song at the beginning of the show. He sang with his wife, Sarah. It's very beautiful. At the end of the program, he sings his version of the Mexican Hat Dance. That's Mike Rickberg. Vilmos fixes JackieCation.com. He is the web designer over there. And Patrick Brady fixes the audio. And in this case, there's a video intro. Very exciting. Anyway, those are the websites. If you want to support the show, you're doing it already by listening to it or watching it. And another way is to tell your friends and family, go on iTunes, do a review. Another way is to just give me money. Yeah. You could go use the donate button. You can make it even monthly if you're okay with making things monthly. You do a PayPal monthly. There's a monthly choice on PayPal. The PayPal is a button on the Jackie Cation or the Dork Forest website, and it goes directly to me. Thank you very much. I will use it wisely or foolishly. Your call as well. Now, my email address, jackie@jackiecation.com, is where you can contact me if you have any questions or concerns and about the Dork Forest. And I do have a Venmo account. It's jackie-cation, oddly enough. Another way to support the show is on dorkforest.com and jackiecation.com. There's an Amazon link. And the Amazon link just takes you to Amazon. You order like normal, and it supports the show because you came from Jackie Cation or dorkforest.com. Very exciting. Other than that, there is a Bandcamp. You can, if you have listened to all the episodes that are free and you need more content, there are several live episodes that are at thedorkforest.bandcamp.com. And those cost me a couple of bucks, so I charge a couple of bucks. There's also a storytelling album there that you can listen to some stories that I did live. And there are 17 free episodes before the Dork Forest was pre-recorded. So the audio isn't very good, but the guests were super funny and fun and dorky. So if you want to do that, go to thedorkforest.bandcamp.com. Other than that, let's see if there are other things that I should be talking about. Possibly the merch. Yeah, if you want to buy merch. The only other thing I want to talk about is the merch. You can get Dork Forest t-shirts, and you can get stand-up comedy t-shirts. You can get my albums or my DVD over at jackiecation.com/merch. There's pins, there's a challenge coin, there's a bunch of new things happening over there. Anyway, a lot of information. I don't think I've missed anything, but who cares? Let's get into the show. Hi, I'm Jackie Cation, and I'm in my living room, and Dominic Ferrantelli is in his living room. And Patrick Brady is audio managing this from Jafar. He's in his living room, one would imagine. But he's muted himself. But I want to talk to Dominic Ferrantelli about RetroTech, because we're in the Dork Forest. And Patrick was like, he knows about laser discs and he knows about this thing. And I'm like, well, I don't know anything about any of that. And I lived through it. So what is happening, Dominic? What do you know about Laserdiscs?
Oh, I know a lot. I have only a few hundred movies on Laserdisc. And I only have, I don't know, like six players.
You have six Laserdisc players?
They each have different features.
Interesting. All right. Talk to me. First of all, the Laserdisc player came out, as the same time as the VHS? When did it come out?
Or
the DVD
close.
Player? Okay.
So the Laserdisc came out technically in 1978 in a limited test run in Atlanta, and then went worldwide in 1979. but VHS came out in 1971.
Oh.
So it was started earlier than VHS was started as a project, but it took them so long to actually come up with a consumer product that it launched way later.
Okay. Wait, so VHS was invented in 71?
That's when it was launched. Sorry, 71 was when they started working on it. 76 was when it launched.
Okay, fair enough. Because in 1976, I will have you know, we got a VHS player in my home. My dad got it as a part payment for a siding job, and it had the old-timey remote with a wire. So,
nice.
Yeah, it actually, which was never long enough to get to the, we had to leave it on top of it anyway.
Yeah.
I was the remote. Hey, go press play on the VHS. And of course it was a top loader.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all very exciting. But now Laserdisc, I think of as kind of an ancient DVD player. Am I right?
Is it? Yeah, it was a higher quality optical disc. Most of them that were released are the size of a record,
right?
They're 12 inches across.
Why? Figured I would,
yeah, and then they're always double sided, and
really,
yeah.
Why?
Yeah, there's never anything printed on the top side like on a DVD or a CD.
So how do you know which side one is what and what is side two?
There's an inner label like along the inside of it
just
that
like
has
a
label
record?
Of A or B. Yep, just like a record.
Just like a okay. I have seen
they were
advertised
as video records.
Video okay. And so if a Laserdisc player were they front loaders or were they top loaders like a record player?
So they started top loaders like a record player. And
okay.
Then when they transitioned away from using helium neon lasers in consumer devices for some reason into solid state lasers, that's when they went to a tray loader from the front.
Okay. What is the difference between helium what?
Helium neon.
Thank you. Helium neon laser and a solid state laser. Do you have any idea what the difference between those are?
So a helium neon laser uses current going through gases in order to generate light, and it actually runs at a slightly different wavelength than the solid state lasers that they were using, which was infrared. The helium neon lasers were like at the cusp of red and infrared.
What the hell? This is so they spent. They're like, we want. Like movie quality movies in our own home. And to do that, we're going to use helium neon lasers to project the images. And did they go on the television or did they go on a wall?
They went to whatever display you had. So at the time, everybody had televisions. By 1975, like 80% of America had color TVs.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, it would just hook right up to your TV. They were advertising it, which was, I think, part of the problem with why it never really took off, was that they were advertising it as a video record or a way for you to watch movies at home, but that wasn't a thing that existed in the world
at
the
time. And for some reason, the porn industry went VHS, which is why everyone else went VHS. where they lead, it turns out, the creepy porn industry. Or is it creepy? Do I have to say that? I don't. Anyway,
no. And
so people can have their lives. So
yeah.
Anyway, but so the laser. So then they went to a solid state laser, which is an ultraviolet. No,
infrared.
Infrared. Thank you. An infrared light, and the quality of this. What is the difference between a VHS and a laser disc? Is it?
Oh, it's
dots
dramatic.
Per inch. It's dramatic.
It's dramatic. It's hard to measure resolution of VHS because it's film being transcoded into a television signal.
Okay.
So the same tape could be played at different resolutions depending on your player.
Oh.
Whereas Laserdiscs okay. are a fixed resolution that is higher and with higher fidelity than any VHS got.
Okay. So it's a fixed resolution. Interesting. And you have hundreds of these discs. How long do you know how long they were? Are they still making them? They're probably.
No, they stopped selling them in the United States in 1999. I think there might have been one or two sold in 2000 new movies.
Okay.
And they continued until about 2002 in Japan.
Okay.
Which is where the biggest market for them was.
From the beginning?
Yeah, pretty much from the beginning. Within, you know, because it takes a few years for you to try to judge adoption rates. Within about 10 years or so, they estimated that they had 10% market penetration in Japan, but only 2% in the United States, and only like 0.8% in Europe.
Wow. 0.8%. Okay.
Yeah, so, it did not do well in Europe.
Right. And it, and so of the, I don't know, do you have actually in your brain box sort of how many movies were put on Laserdisc, or was it just that 2% of whatever movies that were coming out, kind of?
Pretty much every major movie released from 1960 something on up to about 1996.
Oh, God. All
and
right.
And then at 1996, it started faltering. And by the time you hit 1999, there were only like three movies released on Laserdisc.
Do you have those three movies from 1999?
I have one of them.
Which one is it?
The Matrix.
Oh, The Matrix came out in 1999?
Yes, it did.
Wow. I'm 100 years old. Anyway, so, because I would have swore it was last year. But movies aren't my life. But here's, I mean, the crazy thing is so the hundreds of laser discs that you have, and this is the first tech that we're even touching on here, have you gone with a theme? Have you gone with classics? Are you just buying them because they exist? How do you pick?
Kind of all over the place. I'm into a lot of different genres of movies, and I don't really have any DVDs or Blu-rays, and most of the movies I watch are older anyway. So if I want to keep a physical copy of it, I get that. I also sometimes will get a movie because there's some special content on Laserdisc that doesn't exist anywhere else.
Oh, like DVD extras, but on laser. But so they had extras on the laser discs.
Yeah, they had art books. They had commentary tracks. They had frequently there were different cuts released on different formats. So there would be scenes released on Laserdisc that weren't released anywhere else and never made it to any of the more modern cuts.
Oh, that's amazing. What is the capacity? Like, could it, I mean, how many megabytes, how many gigs, how big a file could be put on that Laserdisc?
So the way that Laserdisc stores information is a bit weird. So it's measured in time. So it can store 30 minutes of video per side in CAV format, or in CLV format, it can store 60 minutes worth of video.
CAV versus CLV, which makes me think that one is better quality than the other?
Yeah, CAV is better quality and has a few distinct advantages quality-wise, including individual frame access, which was really big for video files.
Oh, that's amazing. Because to go frame by frame to some extent?
Yeah, you can go frame by frame. You can also put in a frame number on your remote and it will call up that frame on the Laserdisc.
Okay. Here's two questions digressing from the technology of it, which
sure.
is, do you have Support Your Local Sheriff on Laserdisc by any chance?
I do not.
It is a not a good movie, but it is an enjoyable movie. It is with, and I'm spacing his name, Rockford Files. Remember that guy? Yep. Anyway, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And but it was a cowboy movie that was, I used to see it on television just on, you know, they would just play it with commercials. And I always thought that it was terrible and it had been cut poorly because of that it was being aired on television. And it turns out, so I bought it on VHS. Mm-hmm. And then I bought it on DVD to check every time. And it turns out it was just poorly cut. It was just a terrible, the way it was just not well, it was not well directed. And then here's the other thing, frame by frame anecdote, which you may or may not care about, in the movie LA Story. Do you have that by any chance? You do. Okay. Then frame by frame, you can go to the scene. I used to have sort of movie viewing parties when I first moved to Los Angeles. And a guy told me this. One of my friends told me this. We would all get together and have a nice evening where we would watch a film, obviously, right? So the LA Story, in the scene where he's buying those white pants, where Steve Martin is, and he first meets Sarah Jessica Parker. Uh-huh. If you go frame by frame, there's a woman in one of the dressing rooms. You get to see a nipple.
Huh.
Thanks for playing. There we go. Little fun fact for you. Yeah. Free nipple, Dominic. who hasn't dreamt of that in one day in their lives? And I don't know why I cared, but I'm not above a nipple. What the heck?
Oh, no.
She seemed a very fit young woman. A lot of sit-ups. Things were happening. So what, are there, do you end up watching them on a regular basis? Like, what are some of your favorites?
I do watch some on a pretty regular basis. Some of my favorites are, Terminator 2, because that cut is incredible. The one, so there were, I want to say 8 different releases of Terminator 2 on Laserdisc.
Really?
So frequently it was released in at least 2 versions, one for CLV, one for CAV. Then for bigger budget movies, there was usually a third release that was like a special edition, includes extra stuff.
Right.
Version.
Why wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And then, but then, you know, the Laserdisc format kept getting updated, so then they'd be like, oh, you know, now we can do Dolby Digital surround sound. Let's re-release the movie, but with surround sound.
Oh, what one do you
which
have?
Which is what they did with Jurassic Park, which was the first movie on Laserdisc to, the first movie available for homes that has surround sound.
Oh my God. And do you have that one?
I do.
I would actually like to see that movie. I haven't seen the original Jurassic Park probably since it came out. I've been on the ride. I get it. It holds up. And then sometimes on cable, you'll be flipping through and you're like, oh, giant raptors. So, is it set up so that you could have a theater experience? Is that how you set it up in your house or in your apartment?
Usually set it up. I have a Laserdisc player right beneath my TV. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the movies that I have are in letterbox format. And then I'll zoom it to fill my, you know, modern TV. I have it going through a video comb filter and then an upscaler to bring it up to closer to native TV resolution. And then crop it out so that you get the full widescreen image.
Oh, wow. Yeah, this is a valid dorkdom here, my friend. You have really, you've stuck the landing, Dominic. The Laserdisc player itself is from, let's say, the 80s or the 90s.
Yeah, this is a mid 90s model.
Okay, so it's a later model, so it's newer. Mm-hmm. What happens? Do you have extra ones because just in case parts? Do you cannibalize them for other parts or? Have you gone through them? Have they broken?
A couple have broken, a couple I have for parts. I also have a Laserdisc player set up in my garage, and that's where I have a bunch of arcade machines and a pinball machine, and I've got an old plasma display up in there, and I play, like, random kaiju movies from,
Just, like, background monster movies?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Just background monster movies.
Nice. Yeah. I just recorded that episode of The Dork Forest about monsters, which is why I recognize the word kaiju. I have to ask you now if you ever saw, it's a relatively new film. I don't know if you've seen it because it's not available on Anne Hathaway produced film called Colossal. Have you seen that? It's a monster movie.
No, I haven't.
It's better than it has any right to be, quite honestly. And I understand why she produced it is because she wanted to be in it and probably would not have been cast. So it's a great movie with literally, for me, one of the best endings of a monster movie. The way they dealt with it was outstanding. So if you get a chance, see Colossal, which is on Hulu. I don't know if you have the streaming services.
I do. I'll check that out.
Yeah. And because the first like 10 or 15 minutes of the movie isn't even a monster movie. It's just a weird, like sort of personal. It's about people, right? As the best monster movies are, I've been told, right? And then it turns into this weird Korean, there are monsters, but who are the real monsters, right? Anyway, so
if a good monster movie should make you think, you know?
Yeah. What is your favorite monster movie? And is there a good monster movie on Laserdisc that has good special, that has extra things on it?
I think probably my favorite is Mothra, and I do have the limited edition box set of Mothra that has all kinds of extra art books and like costume design stuff. It's great.
Wow. I mean, I actually have seen Mothra, and I had forgotten that it makes sense that Mothra could fly, but I had forgotten. And Steve Mandel reminded me that he was a moth. Even though he was a monster. So you have an arcade setup. Is it a bunch of retro tech as well? Like it, or is it just PS4? You're playing Spider-Man.
No, I don't have any LCDs in the garage at all. Okay. Everything is CRTs except for the one plasma display. That's a like a very
the
early.
What does the CRT stand for? I forget.
Cathode ray tube.
Okay. Nice. Okay. So sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. The way they work is bonkers, and we can get into that if you like.
Yeah, but please do.
So a CRT, basically the way that it works is there are three electron guns in the back of that glass tube. And each electron gun fires a row of light, approximately somewhere between, depending on the quality of the CRT, somewhere between 400 and 800 lines on the screen to draw the image.
Right.
And then we see, quote, pixels because there's usually a filter right behind the glass that is what's making it actually be pixels. Otherwise, it would just appear like just lines.
Right. Okay, go ahead.
And then horizontally, it is pushing out, I can't think of the number exactly offhand, but it's somewhere in the vicinity of 600 columns.
Okay.
And it's updating what image it should be portraying on three guns for each pixel 60 times a second.
And
this was all happening that fast in 1972 or 3, whenever color got big.
Right, because previously it was just black and white television. Mm-hmm. And black and white television was not done by cathode ray, or it was?
That was cathode ray too, but it was just a single gun.
And so it was just projecting.
It was just projecting grayscale, basically.
Grayscale.
So it was all black, and then it would shoot out white, and then at different intensities, so it would make different shades of gray.
And this may be the most simplistic thing that I've ever said in my life, but I don't understand how images are sent over wire. I don't get how a fax machine works. I don't get how a television works, because is it coming through a wire? Is it coming through the antenna? Is it satellites? How was it happening in 1955, for example?
In the 50s, television was entirely over antenna. Okay. There wasn't home cable yet. So there would be, you know, your local television station with a broadcast antenna on top, like a radio station. And then they would broadcast out their either pre-recorded tapes or some live content, like the Late Show or something.
Okay, or like this, the news, the 6 o'clock news from their place.
And from their place. And then that would get transmitted over radio, which the idea that we can use fluctuations of energy in the air to transmit data is kind of bonkers.
Yes! Yes! That's exactly what's bonkers. I don't know how that... How is data... Is it... I don't know how it works. Is it binary? What's happening?
So that wasn't binary. That was an analog stream. And...
Okay.
When you get to analog, it gets really complicated really fast. Binary is simple because it's either on or off. One or zero. Right.
Yeah.
You know? And so you're just like, oh yeah, at this point in the wave, there's either a low value or a high value, and that sets one or zero. That's easy. Sort of like how on a CD, that's the way that it works. There are pits in the disc, and there's a light sensor. And so whenever it's hitting the reflective part, the laser hitting the reflective part, then that's a one. And then when it hits a pit, then the sensor doesn't pick up anything. So that's a zero.
Okay. So it's like computer punch cards.
Yeah.
They were do a thing or don't do a thing. That was the whole plan, right? So analog video coming over antennae is something else again.
Yes. So that's okay. That's analog, which, so instead of there being, are you familiar with the square wave?
No.
So, no, that's all right. Okay. So you're familiar with what a sine wave looks like, roughly. The ideal up and down sort of. Yeah.
Okay.
So a square wave is that, but boxes. So it's just low, straight line up, high, straight line down, low.
Oh, okay.
And then, so for digital signal, that's the way it works. So as you have a wave of data over the air, within every little tiny part of that, it's either up a bit or down a bit.
Okay.
And so that either says one or zero, and that's how we transmit digital data over radio, roughly. I'm hand-waving a lot of this.
Please.
But yeah. But then when you get to analog, it's instead of it just being high or low, it's a gradation. So within that big wave of the full radio signal, you then have little gradations that indicate what is being transmitted the whole way.
Okay. Yeah. And this is just coming over radio waves. This is just a manipulation, as you said, of energy to pass information that then is translated. Is there a scramble box, a reassembling of this information from its takeoff to where it lands? Or is it just the same box accepting it and just reassembling it?
Pretty much that, until we started getting to cable services that were trying to lock you out if you weren't paying for certain channels. They weren't necessarily scrambled or encrypted or anything.
Okay.
But yeah, it would be in some format that's able to be transmitted, and then your TV would go, okay, I've got this, you know, this bunch of waves. I'm going to turn this into instructions for these electron guns to fire electrons at this glass, and that's going to make an image.
I feel like I almost get it. And that means, Dominic, that you have done some vital work here. And because science isn't my strong suit, math isn't my strong suit, but I'm not I have some comprehension. So I appreciate how you've explained that because I feel better. But I do want to know what games you have in the garage.
I have generic cabs that I swap games in and out of. So okay. In the United States, it was much more common for games to ship in their own cab, and then the whole cab would be themed for that game. So all the art on the side permanently attached, you know, the marquee on top and everything.
Yeah.
But in other countries where there wasn't as much space as the United States, like in Europe and in Japan, et cetera, companies would release sort of multi-use cabs. So like Sega released a line of cabs and Taito released a line of cabs. And they say Taito on them, but they don't have like a game label or anything. There's usually a marquee holder on the top.
Yeah.
That way, as you're walking by, you can tell what game is in it.
Okay. Yeah. Whenever I see what I call uprights, because that was the first games, those are the only ones I played. Like right. We never got into video games in my house when I was a child, right? The only thing mm-hmm. I believe that would have been available would have been like an Atari kind of situation. It was the first computer game, which was Adventure. I remember playing these games at other people's homes. It was exciting. But then...
my square tattoo on my arm is because Adventure is my favorite video game.
That is awesome. I might need a picture of that for the slug.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. So it was great. But then when I went to college, essentially, it was for the first time in my life, I had more money than because I got Pell Grants, I got loans. I had never had this much money in my entire life. And I spent the first 4 or 5 weeks, I think it was, I spent $75 a week on video games until I met a guy who had to drop out of college because he had spent all of his money on video games, at which point I decided to make friends with the guy who was the manager at Spaceport. And then he would occasionally give me free games. So it went down. It made it much more realistic. So do sure. you have... do you have games? What are the first games that I played were at the bowling alley when I was like 16. So it was mm-hmm. Galaga. It was Donkey Kong. It was
Pac-Man, Frogger.
Right, your Pac-Mans, your Froggers, your Ms. Pac-Man. Ms. Pac-Man yeah. is so much better. Just better puzzles. And more story.
And faster.
A lot faster. Yeah. But Gorf, did you ever play Gorf?
I have played Gorf. That's a weird one.
It is. It is not very good. It had a lot of potential because it was essentially five games in one. And mm-hmm. But each one was mediocre. It was poorly done five times in a row.
Did you ever play there were two Tron arcade games. There was Discs of Tron and then there was just Tron.
I played just Tron. I tried to play Discs of Tron. It was not my jam.
Not mine either, but regular Tron. I'm all about that one. And that's a similar thing where it's four different games.
Right.
There's like the tank one and, you know, there's a bunch of them and it's great.
Right. There was a tank game, I remember, where you actually had to move and, yeah, it would fall down and you would put your mm-hmm. face up to it like it was goggles. That can't be healthy. And then... And then it had those two levers like an actual tank where you got to where you're literally you had to think spatially.
Mm-hmm.
And know that if you go one way, you'll turn and back up and go. And if you go the other way, you'll go forward and turn the other way. So we're doing a lot of hand motions. This is a podcast. And then there's your classics, your Joust. And mm-hmm. I loved me some Joust.
So
I like
Joust
Paperboy.
Is the first one we've said, aside from Gorf, that I don't have. Paperboy also I don't have because the controls for that are complicated and would be difficult without a dedicated cab.
Right, because are you using the same? So you have to essentially get a game that can be repurposed in a cab, right? Is that what it is?
Yeah, so the majority of the games that I have are played with like a joystick and buttons, you know, standard arcade controls.
Sure.
And then I've also got some games that work with a spinner. So I've got the Sega arcade cabs have replaceable control panels.
Okay.
So I've got a spinner panel that goes in there and then it just like connects in. And that way I can hook up the spinners to the games that use spinners.
Is the spinner, or is that what you're calling the ball that that you push, so, or no?
No, that's a trackball.
Trackball, you're right.
A spinner is like what you use to play Asteroids.
Okay. Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, man, I was terrible at Asteroids because it's such a, it's a real sensitive set of, Are you pretty good at it? Or?
The vector physics are crazy in that game. I am terrible at it, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's if you're willing to commit, I mean, that's what it is with video games, is if you have, and every time I've tried to use a new system, you know, it's a 14-hour learning curve of how to use the controller and the joystick and sort of get the vibe for the, it's almost a muscle memory that has to be created and can only be created by iteration, you know? Which is unfortunate, which is why when one game would go to the next game, you're like, well, it better have the same. Like, I was always a Mortal Kombat player and not a Street Fighter.
Same.
Right, because it was 6-button configuration versus 5-button configuration. Do you have any of the boxes that are that have the 5 or 6 button, or is it just 1 button, 1 joystick?
So I've got a panel with 3 buttons, which is the official JAMA standard, which is
like ABC?
Yeah, ABC.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go for it.
And that was a rough standard that people mostly stuck to, that came about in the 80s until that connector got deprecated in the 90s. And then I've also got, I've got 6-button panels, like for playing Street Fighter or, you know, other fighting games like that. And then I've also got a panel that has the cross 5 buttons.
Yep. It's and so what's in there now? What kind of games, like how many cabs do you have and how many games are on in each cab?
So I've got 2 cabs right now. And one I've got, it's a Neo Geo cab, so it's got 4 games in it. So I've got Puzzle Bobble, Bust a Move in the United States.
Sure.
Then I've got a Bomberman game that was released for that. I've got Twinkle Star Sprites, which is, it's a crazy game.
I don't know about it.
It is a vertical shooter that you play versus another character, sort of like the versus in Bust a Move, where like you get a combo and you send stuff to the other side.
Yeah.
But it's a vertical shooter. So like enemies will come down from the top of the screen and you can cause a chain reaction of explosions among those, and then that'll send stuff over to the other side.
Right, right. Awesome. And
And then I've got Neo Turf Masters, which is a really silly golf game.
Oh, fun.
Yeah.
The sports games are always interesting in the old uprights anyway. You know, there was track and field, which just had 2 buttons and you had to beat the shit out of them. But it was athletic. And then I really liked, there was a skateboarding game called 360. And that I was really good at. And I thought it translated to real skateboarding. And I broke my wrist. It wasn't great.
Aww.
But it looked good in the moment, I bet. My niece and nephew said it was pretty funny. So, but I liked, there was a one, I believe it was just a 1-button for the fire and then a joystick. And it was, and I've seen it since in sort of the cabs that'll have a bunch of games in them. And it's called Zaxxon. Did you ever get to play that one?
Yeah. Zaxxon was one of the first games that I played on the Atari 2600.
Okay, because in the upright and in the 2600, the depth perception, because the art was a little wonky.
Yeah, it was isometric, so it was a little weird.
Yes, you had to, because they were going for a 3D vibe, but you had to kind of memorize where to go instead of actually eyeball where to go.
Yeah.
It was kind of an interesting, some of those old games, were so fun. Like Dig Dug had this, not Dig Dug, Q-Bert had that same sort of illusion that would, and you'd end up jumping off the edge of the game board.
Constantly.
Yeah. And so, and then how about Dragon's Lair? Speaking of laser discs, did you, first?
I love that game. I actually have I have a laser disc from one of the original arcade machines, and for a while I had a motherboard too, but trying to get all of the things to hook up to it was more than I was willing to put into it.
Yeah.
So, I just play with an emulator, but on the original Laserdisc in a Laserdisc player. That's one of the reasons why I have another Laserdisc player, is I have one that is compatible with the commands that, that game sends.
That is awesome. That was such a great game. And I just, you ever fall in love because someone is really good at a video game? I did. Anyway, it was a different time. It was a We've all been there. 1983. His name was Bob. Anyway, he had memorized all of the different key commands, because it was a joystick, but you had to go tink, 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 and you had to do it in the right. The timing had to be perfect.
Yeah, that was all it was. That game was about memorization and timing.
That was it. How about? Did you ever see a hologram video game? It was a time travel hologram.
Yeah, with the bubble. there was. I think it was just called Time Travel.
Yes, oddly enough. Yeah.
There were two other games released on that platform, and I, for the life of me, cannot remember what they're called.
No, me neither. You know when you see a game.
Those were also laser discs.
Oh, were they?
Yeah.
It makes sense because of how beautiful the graphics were.
Yeah, there were laser discs of live action video being projected up, and they were basically using like tricks of different pieces of glass to make it look like the image was a hologram and like in 3D space.
Right.
But it was just an angled piece of glass.
And it was such a terrible game.
It was horrible.
Yeah, they couldn't get the tech right. To be able to play it. And much like Gorf, where you're just like, this should be the greatest game in the world. You know, it's my husband makes video games. And one of the first games he made that was an interactive, it was a driving game on the iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And he made it for Cars 2, the movie. And you would buy the car and you would get the app. And you could just use, there was you could just use a cardboard thing. Like, you didn't have to buy the cars, but you could collect the cars. And you would drive around and you would go get gas, or you would hang out with Mater, or you would do these things. And it looked so cool, and kids really loved it. But he was telling me one time about how there was a game that came out about a year after that one, put out by Hot Wheels. And Hot Wheels did several things that Disney had not done that made the game so much better. But even them, they didn't have the interaction that was needed. But the Hot Wheels game, first of all, the car that it came with, the wheels actually moved. So,
That's cool.
So you could use it as a car. You could use it as a toy. The other one, the wheels were stationary because it was just a thing that touched the iPad screen. And the Hot Wheel car, the wheels retracted, and then you touched the iPad screen and it was fine. So, but it was, you know, the tech on this stuff, the learning curve is so interesting. I've run out of things to say about that, but I was very excited about it.
That's really cool.
What's your other favorite, what else you got sitting around that house? I wonder.
Well, we only covered my first arcade cab.
Right. Please.
The other arcade cab right now has Dangan Fever Run.
I don't know that one.
It is a Japanese vertical shooter where I have the screen oriented vertically. And it's disco themed.
What?
And yeah, so you're like, you're fighting against someone who hates disco, and every time you blow up an enemy, like little disco guys come falling out, and you got to collect all the disco guys.
What's it called?
Dangan Fever Run.
Dangan Fever Run. Okay. That's hilarious.
You can buy it on PS4 if you live in Japan.
And what is the button configuration on that? What's the joystick?
It's a joystick and two buttons. A third button. So you have single fire, special, like bomb, and then auto fire as the third button.
Wow. Do you have to save up to use auto fire? Or
you can just use it, but it doesn't build up your special as much as just firing regularly.
Fair enough. What else you got on that one?
That one right now is a single game cab, but I was actually playing Donkey Kong in that last week.
Okay.
I've got Pac-Man. Frogger.
Do you have to physically swap out the hardware?
Yeah. So each game is, depending on which game, is a pretty large PCB, printed circuit board.
Thank you.
So I would say like Pac-Man is probably the biggest. It's a good like foot and a half by a foot.
Right.
And then like Donkey Kong is also pretty big. It's about 18 inches by about 8 inches, but it's two PCBs stacked on top of one another.
Right.
And then like Frogger gets pretty small. That's only about like 12 by 7 or so.
And do you have to secure it with like screws and nuts and bolts and stuff? Do you have to actually, or does it place and just stay there pretty good, pretty well?
Because I'm not an operator, I can place it and it's fine. If I were running an arcade, I would want to secure the board in. And then, so there's, in every, well, for American cabs, they're all made of wood. So you just screw right into them. And then for the Japanese cabs, they're usually made out of metal or fiberglass or some combination thereof.
Huh.
So in the bottom, there would be a piece of MDF that you can screw the boards into.
Okay. Yeah. Cause at an arcade, there's a lot of shaking, there's hitting, there's rage.
Yeah. And then, you know, the machine's going to have something wrong with it. You're going to take it into the back. You're going to throw it on a dolly. Things are going to be rattling around. You don't want your board rattling around inside.
Fair enough, because they are literally just computer boards, right? Motherboards?
Yeah.
Of a sort?
Yeah, it's effectively a, like, a lot of them even, like, from the late 80s, early 90s, had a 68,000 processor, the same kind that Apple computers had at the time.
Okay. Wow. That is awesome. So, is there something that you want, like, in video game land or Laserdisc land that you don't, that you're on the lookout for?
I'm trying to keep an eye out for a reasonably priced Initial D cab.
What's that?
That is a racing game made by Sega that they did the full, like, cross everything. It was an anime, it was a manga, it was, you know, all the things.
Wow.
And I just, something about Sega racing physics really does it for me. And so if you have one of those cabs, then you can play pretty much any Initial D game. And at this point, there are 9. The last one just came out like 2-3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They've been releasing since 2002, I think.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. I mean, at a certain point, do you make a lateral move to a different technology? Does it expand on itself? You're like, oh, you hit a wall and then you learn about something and you're like, oh, I got to go in that rabbit hole and start grabbing those items.
Totally. That happens a lot.
What's led to what?
I mean, in general, the arcade hobby has led to a lot of extra stuff. I've got a full set of steering controls that were pulled from an arcade cab that I can just like put on a table and play arcade racing games at home.
Little pole position. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or like Crazy Taxi or.
Sure. I liked Crazy Taxi.
That Crazy was Taxi's really fun.
You ever play Hydro Thunder?
Without having
Thunder?
The like.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Hydro Thunder was a lot of fun too.
Yeah, really well done. And H2 Overdrive, which is the sequel, well played. And anybody who's still making upgrade video games, hats off to him, quite honestly. It's some of this, there was a sniper one that came out a couple of years ago, probably 10 or 15 years ago now, but it gave me vertigo.
And something Silhouette. I'm trying to remember the name.
That was it. It was like Sniper Silhouette or yeah, it was like that. It was Silhouette. And I remember looking through the scope going, this is actually way too, it felt realistic. It felt too, like I was having vision issues with it. Morality didn't bother me. I was playing a video game. I knew the difference between reality and fiction. So
yeah, but it's like, it even the same way that if you're looking down a real scope, if you're off center, it like cuts off the image a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to do the, like the weird, like use both eyes, but not in order to be able to. Yeah. It's remarkably like actually firing a rifle.
Right. It felt it had, and then Time Crisis had kind of a fake recoil that always made me laugh. But it too was either in a pink or yellow gun or whatever. And then you would reload with a foot pedal. I admired the fact that they made it look like there was a recoil, and you're like, I need that.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. The gun con with recoil is the best.
Yeah. I think that those are the Time Crisis series and the Hydro Thunder series are probably the last two. Though House of the Dead wasn't bad. Did you ever play that zombie
shooter? I really enjoyed
shooter?
House of the Dead. Yeah.
That was a...
I wish I could have the first one at home, but the way the light sensors work for those guns is bonkers.
Why is that? What is it? How is it different from any of the guns or just the House of the Dead one?
Specifically House of the Dead one was just different from everybody else. And then once you started getting into LCD cabs for like House of the Dead 3 and 4,
right.
Then the gun technology gets even more complicated. And they're like these complex light arrays that go around the whole screen. Mm-hmm. And the gun reads in these complex light arrays that are, if you don't wire them up correctly, can damage each other.
Wow. Yeah, I believe the how complex and how great they look, that makes so much sense. You know, we got a PS4 about 6 months ago, or no, would have been over. Yeah, would have been a year ago, and I've since played. I've only tried to play the Spider-Man game, mm-hmm. and just because
it's a good one,
it is a good one. I myself have a hard time having video games around the house because once I start, it's a clock eater, man. All of a sudden, yep. I have not achieved anything except for leveling up. So, but it doesn't, I was like, so if I don't turn the PS4 on, then I don't play the new God of War and then I don't have to do it, right? Except for the fact that on my phone, I have a little game called Marvel Puzzle Quest, which is just a match three superhero fight game versus, and easily 5 or 6 hours a day. There's nothing. There's a no win there.
So, no, there's no escape.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I might as well play the one that cost, you know, $23,000 to make.
Why not?
Oh, well. That feels like I just lowballed that game. So, all right. Well, we're getting close to an hour here. We've barely touched on anything but Laserdiscs and your video games. What else is in the garage? Should I know about?
Well, there's a pinball machine.
Which one?
There is I've got an Attack from Mars.
Oh, wow.
That's my absolute favorite game. And Chicago Gaming recently has been remaking older pinball machines mm-hmm. with modern electronics driving them. So it's just a BeagleBone Black inside of a pinball cab driving the whole thing, which I think is really which is a competitor for the Raspberry Pi.
Okay, those are all words. Let's unpack it. Attack from Mars. Was it what year is the original on that one?
1997.
So. It's ramps and, but it has an interface, right? It has the board, which is more digital.
Yeah, it's got a digital matrix display, which is basically just like a grid of LEDs. So yeah. Super low resolution. But, you know, it was enough to display pictures of aliens. And, you know, there's a mode where you like use a tractor beam and you see like a HAL getting picked up in a tractor beam. And it's got a UFO in the center that you have to hit a bunch and it shakes every time you hit it. Awesome. And there's a bunch of aliens all over the playfield that when you get a certain multi-ball, they all start shaking.
That is so cool. I've seen on some of the and newer is so not what I mean, but newer, they have stories that are worked into those LED, even with those that small amount of graphic. Is there a little scene that works out on Attack from Mars that plays out?
Not tremendously. It's basically just Mars is attacking. You're trying to save five different cities.
Okay.
So you progress. Usually arcades have it set to a random order of the cities. So that way people who are playing can get the different voices because it's very funny, all of their reactions.
Like, right.
Horrible accents that I won't try to replicate because they're enough. Offensive, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure they're very sensitive.
But then you get to the end, and if you save all of the cities, then you go to Mars, and then you defeat the Martians on Mars.
Oh, the boss! That's fantastic. That's, you know, because some of the thing about pinball machines can sometimes just feel like a button masher. You know, you're just like, I don't feel like I have any aim or any sort of direction. You're just trying to keep the ball in play as much. So a pinball machine has to be so, I think, incredibly well written so that you know exactly what you're supposed to be doing. And sometimes they aren't, they're, it's sort of like a textbook where you're like, well, now I have to figure out what the point and purpose of this game is so that I can play it. So not correctly, but correctly. Right?
Sure. Yeah, Twilight Zone is like that, where there are not a whole lot of visual cues as to what you should be doing at any given time.
Yes!
But if you know how to play the game, it's incredibly complex.
Like, right!
Insanely complex rule set, but almost no visual cues for what you should be doing.
There is an episode of The Dork Forest, probably 3 or 4 years ago now, where it was a pinball dork he was on, and he completely was into pinball games, but he decided that he only wanted to tell me one path to victory on a Lord of the Rings game. And he also told me that in my neighborhood, and I did not know this at the time, there is a Korean restaurant that has like 20
pinball. Oh, you're Darius Gogi.
Yeah. Well,
I love that place.
Yeah, it's over on Van Nuys Boulevard okay. So he was like, there is an app that shows you pinball machine places. And he was like, they have that Lord of the Rings game there. And I went, and it must have been being like fixed or cleaned or something, because they did not have it. And I had the food and it was just okay. So I have not been back.
Yeah.
But I do want to try that Lord of the Rings game. And he did just the walkthrough of the one way that you could. He said there were many ways that you could get to Mordor. And I was like, wow, you don't just walk into Mordor. So I had to say
that. You had to. It was a requirement.
Exactly. Dominic, we're at. Like, I just want to tell people, because the thing is you don't really have an online, you're not really doing it. You're not on Twitter, you're not, and you're not plugging anything. So what this has been is been a discussion with someone who knows some stuff. And I thoroughly have enjoyed this. Dominic Ferrantelli, he has dorked out. And it has been an exciting, really cool. This has been great. I mean, quite honestly, you explaining cathode rays to me has got to be my favorite part of this entire thing. And then us reminiscing about old-timey video games. But I'd love to have you back on if you want to talk about two other parts of...
Oh, absolutely. We could talk about plasma displays. We could talk about CEDs. We didn't even get there.
What's
capacitive
a CED?
Electronic discs.
What is that?
Do we have time to cover one more thing?
One more thing. Let's
okay.
Teaser.
So MCA, the Music Corporation of America, and Pioneer were the two companies that were behind Laserdisc.
Okay.
And then a competitor that launched about a year before was the CED, or the Capacitive Electronic Disc, released by RCA.
Okay.
And theirs was actually a video record.
How is that?
So there were these, you know, record-sized things that came in these giant plastic cartridges, and you'd put the, because you couldn't touch them, otherwise they would get messed up.
Oh.
So you'd put the cartridge into the player and pull the exterior of the cartridge out, and the disc would stay in the player.
Okay.
And then it had grooves in it, like a record, and it had, instead of a needle point like a record, it had a like bell hook shape, and there were two sets of grooves on the disc, and current would be applied through that loop, through that that needle,
right.
And it would generate capacitance in between those two separate grooves, and that capacitance made a radio frequency that then carried the video and audio from the disc.
What? And so how many of those do you have, or how many of those are there?
That only stayed on the market for like 8 years, so that one didn't do as well. Video degraded pretty hard. I used to have a player and about 10 movies, but I noticed, like, once they start getting bad, it gets much worse every play.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, okay, well, now I can't watch them, so why do I own this if I can't use it?
Right. I might as well just frame it, make a diorama of the things you most admire. Wow, that is kind of fascinating. What movies did you have? What movies did you get to see in that format?
I saw The Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
I saw Escape from New York.
Okay.
Wow. I saw this weird German mixed animation live action film, Dunderklumpen, I believe. Okay. It was called.
Okay. So
yeah, it was just like a few movies that
across the
happened
board
to be there. Yeah.
And that they just were like, well, we're gonna put these out.
Yeah, and why not?
That is an excellent button on the show. Thank you so much. Dominic Ferrantelli, you guys, we learned things. We shared some things. We talked to each other from far away. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Of course. And maybe one day I can be on when we don't have to be so far away.
That'd be great. I would love that, because you're even far away from the camera. So I will say this. Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat, my hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?